The following is Redemption Through Sin by Robert Seffer. Most people have heard of Jesus Christ, considered by Christian followers to be the Messiah who lived over 2,000 years ago. But very few people have ever heard of Sabbatai Zevi, who declared himself to be the Messiah in 1666. He amassed a following of over 1 million believers, half the world's Jewish population, during the 17th century, by proclaiming that redemption was available through acts of sin. Considered a heretic by many of his contemporary rabbis, nonetheless, his fame extended far and wide. Sabbatai's adherents planned to abolish many of the ritualistic observances, because according to the Talmud, in the Messianic time, there would no longer be holy obligations. Fasting days became days of feasting and rejoicing. Sexual promiscuity, adultery, incest, and religious orgies were encouraged and practiced by Sabbateans. After Sabbatai Zevi's death in 1676, his philosophy would be continued and expanded on by his Kabbalist successor Jacob Frank. Frankism, a religious movement of the 18th and 19th centuries, centered on the leadership of the Messiah claimant Jacob Frank. He, like Zevi, would perform strange acts that violated traditional religious taboos, such as eating fats that were forbidden by Jewish dietary laws, ritual sacrifice, promoting orgies, and sexual immorality. Jacob Frank would eventually enter into an alliance formed by Adam Weishaupt and Meyer Amschel Rothschild called the Order of the Illuminati. The objective of this organization was to undermine the world's religious and power structures in an effort to usher in a utopian era of global communism covertly ruled by their hidden hand, the New World Order. Using secret societies, such as the Freemasons, their agenda has played itself out over the centuries, staying true to the script. Opposition is handled by a near-total control of the world's media, academic opinion leaders, politicians, and finance, while still considered a conspiracy theory to many. More people are waking up each day to the reality that this is not just a theory, but a true conspiracy. Chapter 1. In 1666, an exceptionally charismatic rabbi and Kabbalist by the name of Sabbatai Zevi, 1626-1676, declared himself to be the Messiah. Born to an affluent family in western Anatolia, he was a particularly eccentric mystic who had attained a massive following of over 1 million devotees during his lifetime, roughly half the world's Jewish population in the 17th century. His extraordinary popularity, according to historians such as Professor Gershom Scholem, resulted largely from the publication and availability of what is today called the Lurianic Kabbalah, named after Rabbi Isaac Luria, 1534-1572. This new Kabbalah enjoyed broad dissemination thanks to the invention of the printing press in the previous century. Jews around the world for the first time had access to occult literature about the deeper meaning of their faith, and the popularity of Jewish mysticism soared. After a particularly harsh period of persecution in European history, this proactive Kabbalistic philosophy, through an ancient mystical system, gave Jews a reason to be excited and optimistic. Part of this system included ways of interpreting the supernatural relationship between events and time, often through letters and numbers. The magical emphasis given on the numerological values of dates contributed greatly to the widely held expectations and hope placed on the coming of a Messiah at the time of Sabbatai Zevi's advent, the 18th day, 666, of the 6th month of the year 1666. Zevi was extremely charming and exuded an inviting personality, as documented by those who knew him. According to an eyewitness, Rabbi Levi ben Ozer, "You must believe that this is how it was. I spoke with people who ate and drank and were near him, who were not proponents of Sabbatai Zevi's, and they told me that there was none like him in stature, and in the way his face looked, like that of one of God's angels. And they testified that when he sang Sabbath hymns to God, which he did several times a day, it was not possible to look into his face. For one who looked at it, it was as if he looked into fire." Sabbatai Zevi was considered very handsome in appearance, and also possessed an enchanting singing voice. Rabbi Leib ben Ozer goes on to describe another phenomenon which added to beliefs in Zevi's messianic claim. And this is one of the greatest occurrences, clearly supernatural, that came to pass in those days, and a reason for the great belief in Sabbatai Zevi, for it happened in many places that prophets arose in hundreds and thousands, women and men, boys and girls, and even little children. All of them prophesied in a holy tongue, and in their language of the Zohar as well. And none of them knew a letter of Hebrew, and all the less so the idiosyncratic language of the Zohar. Many rabbis of the time publicly attested to having had dreams in which Sabbatai appeared to them, sometimes by the side of their bed, and when they awoke, they would profess that he was the Messiah. According to Professor Gershom Scholem, a sincere expectation arose in the psyche of many Jews, especially in Europe following the Spanish Inquisition, that biblical prophecy would be fulfilled via a Jewish homeland. According to some critical interpretations of his behavior, Sabbatai showed signs of what modern scholars would likely call manic depressive psychosis. In other words, he publicly displayed at times ecstatic behavior, often followed by bouts of seclusion or possibly depression. He also violated numerous religious laws, from dietary restrictions to committing acts of sexual immorality. On the other hand, some scholars and modern-day followers, or Neo-Sabbateans, have argued that his behavior did not point to psychosis, but rather was simply what one should expect from a religious mystic, such as a Sufi. Meditative chanting, prayer trance, dancing, etc. According to Professor Avraham El-Qayyam, faculty member of the Jewish Philosophy Department at Bar-Ilan University in Israel, Sabbatai engaged frequently in Bektashi Sufi rituals. This perspective seems reasonable to me, as Sabbatai Zevi's final gravesite in Albania was made into a Sufi shrine, as it remains even to this day. In any event, Zevi's unusual, or socially immoral and religiously unacceptable behavior, finally got him expelled from Smyrna around 1650, and he wandered for years through Greece, Thrace, Egypt, and Syria. In 1665, his life forever changed upon meeting Nathan of Gaza in Palestine, the rabbi who persuaded him that he was indeed the Messiah to usher in the New Age, and who would become known as one of the greatest proponents and interpreters. Sabbatai Zevi was convinced and formally revealed himself after considerable encouragement from Nathan, making his pronouncement in the year 1666, as to fulfill messianic prophecy. He soon gained fervent support in the Diaspora, areas outside Palestine settled by Jews, by promising a return to a Jewish homeland, a message that was then well received. Despite his strong support and popularity among the Jewish people, the leading rabbis of Jerusalem rejected Sabbatai's claim as Messiah. They basically told him to leave the city or be excommunicated. Very disappointed but undeterred, Sabbatai returned to Turkey, where the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire had already allowed the Zevi phenomena to unfold for several years. The Sultan did not initially oppose Zevi's religious claims, probably because those claims brought in so much money from Jewish tourism. As Jews flocked to Turkey from all over the world, from England to Persia, Germany to Morocco, Poland to Yemen. Though at first the Sultan did not interfere with Sabbatai's movement, the last straw came, according to one of many rumored accounts, when Sabbatai publicly proclaimed that, in next year, the temple in Jerusalem would be rebuilt. The Sultan took umbrage. The most commonly accepted version of the story is that the Sultan offered Sabbatai the choice of either publicly converting to Islam or being beheaded. As the Sultan so delicately put it, "Your head or the turban." The turban was, of course, a symbol for converting to Islam. Sabbatai Zevi, the proposed long-awaited Messiah, denounced his Jewish faith on the spot and chose to wear the turban and keep his head. Zevi publicly became a Muslim and adopted a new name, Aziz Mehmed Efendi, Power of Muhammad. The Sultan gave him a reasonable salary as the Sultan's personal doorman and the cryptic title Keeper of the Gate. All the while, it seems, he continued in his messianic activities, acting with, one must assume, the full knowledge of the Islamic authorities. Sabbatai may have converted to escape execution, but Nathan and his other loyal followers put a different interpretation on his transition. According to them, Sabbatai's conversion represented the descent into the Klipotic realm, grossest reality, or husks, of creation, in order to reclaim the lost sparks of divine light, which is meant to repair the world. These are Kabbalistic concepts, which most modern scholars have concluded were all too often used to justify his heretical and socially radical behavior. Sabbatai's formal conversion to Islam dismayed many of his followers, to say the least, but those who continued to be loyal to the movement took it as a sign to also convert to Islam, while secretly maintaining their Jewish identity and mystical practices. The most famous of these Sabbatean cults, as they were sometimes called, was primarily located in Anatolia, modern Turkey. Detractors called them the Donme, which translates to religious converts, a derogatory term which they themselves never used. Nathan's optimistic interpretation of Sabbatai's change of faith did not sit well with most Jews, but it did find a great degree of acceptance in places like Spain and Portugal. Among the conversos, converts, and Maranos, two names for Western European Jews who were forced to convert to Christianity during the Inquisition. According to Rabbi Yaakov Lieb HaKohain, the current director of Donme West, a Californian neo-Sabbatean organization founded in 1972, it is commonly held conjecture that Sabbatai Zevi's conversion to Islam was an act of cowardice that betrayed the Jewish people. However, this conversion was not an act of cowardice, but in fact one of the mystical Ma'asim Zarim, strange actions, that he and Nathan of Gaza believed the Messiah was destined to perform, based on their reading of the Kabbalah. Such an unorthodox and controversial explanation suggests that the collapse of Sabbatai Zevi's worldwide movement, and almost of Judaism itself, resulted not so much from what Sabbatai did, as from the inability of the Jewish people to understand and accept it. In other words, it was not Sabbatai Zevi who betrayed the Jewish people, but they who misunderstood and therefore, according to Mr. HaKohain's view, abandoned him. Sabbatai Zevi, like the Sufi mystics, used to loudly exclaim words of ecstasy. Sabbatai was said to have taken part in the Sufi Bektashi rites conducted at Adrianopolis. In many ways, the Sunni majority considers the Bektashi order and Alevis antinomian, lawless. So it is interesting that Sabbatai Zevi chose to affiliate with them. In many regards, the Bektashi Alevi, Sufi, fall beyond the limits of acceptable Muslim behavior. Many Bektashi Alevi do not follow the prescribed 5-day prayers, preferring instead to offer their prayers privately or at Kem, the religious gathering place of the Alevi, nor do they adhere to the fasting during Ramadan. Many Bektashi Alevis drink alcohol and do not regard it as sinful, unlike the majority Orthodox belief. They also emphasize the equality between men and women, who may practice together in the Kem, and in Zikrullah, the gathering place for Zikir. For the pilgrimage or Hajj to Mecca, they substitute a pilgrimage to the shrines of Sufi saints, or visit to living Babas or Dedes, their religious elders and leaders. The notion that Sabbatai held Sufism in high regard and practiced its Gnostic techniques is one that Professor Gershom Scholem seems to have failed to notice or adequately bring to light. The goal of this spiritual conversion, according to many modern Dome, was to bring about a sacred reconciliation between two religions, rather than to practice either. The theory is that one accomplished this by internalizing an opposing or alien religion into one's own person in order to reconcile inwardly what is outwardly antagonistic, thereby reconciling two seemingly opposite systems and raising up the holy sparks in each to their sources. But what are these holy sparks, and where did they come from? Isaac Luria, whose interpretation of the Kabbalah is now most widely used and accepted, explained that God created the world by forming 10 vessels to hold the divine light. God intended this original light to radiate out, fill the world, and illuminate everything around us. But as God poured the light into the vessels, the divine light was so powerful that the vessels couldn't contain it. With a huge explosion, the vessels shattered, and sparks of this divine light became embedded into the world of matter. The material world had trapped these sparks of divine light. God's presence was hidden and unable to shine forth. It then became the task for us, presumably the chosen ones, to free these holy sparks. The manner in which people approach and interact with the material universe could set these sparks free and repair the world. In figure 3 here, if you're not familiar with it, they're showing the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Another key aspect of Isaac Luria's interpretation, now known as the Lurian Kabbalah, is that it required active participation to set the stage for the arrival of the Messiah. He designed his new Kabbalistic instructions for liberating holy sparks to bring about the conditions that would set the stage, initiate, or directly expedite the fulfillment of Jewish messianic prophecy. In other words, instead of simply waiting for God to act, the Lurianic perspective expected Jews to play an active role in bringing forth God's kingdom on earth. This new European Kabbalah, unanimously attributed to Luria, was extremely popular at the time and is still the most broadly disseminated and used Kabbalistic system taught. The Kabbalah became a magical synthesis between pagan teachings, which preceded the Torah, and Gnostic elements of Judaism. Many texts pertaining to the Kabbalah, including the Zohar, say that the task is not to destroy evil, but to return it to its source. To put it simply, to include the left within the right. In the Zoharic metaphor, or to uplift the fallen sparks, in the Lurianic one. The occult scholar, mystic, orientalist, and renowned author of The Secret Doctrine, Madame H.P. Blavatsky, commented that, "Mistaken is he who accepts the Kabbalistic works of today, Kabbalah and the interpretations of the Zohar by the rabbis, for the genuine Kabbalistic lore of old. For no more today than in the day of Friedrich von Schelling does the Kabbalah accessible to Europe and America contain much more than ruins and fragments, much distorted remnants still of that primitive system which is the key to all religious systems." Madame Blavatsky added that the Chaldean was the oldest and likely the most authentic version of the Kabbalah. The Chaldean Kabbalah, moreover, the Book of Numbers, agrees perfectly with the Eastern arrangement, and disagrees with the present Orthodox Kabbalah in its diagrams. "I saw they had changed it in the most wonderful way. The Kabbalah was entirely lost. Now in the Chaldean Kabbalah, in the Book of Numbers, you have the wisdom of the Hebrew initiates, but you have not got it in this, i.e. modern popular and accepted versions of the Kabbalah. They have been so interfering with it. I say there is more flapdoodle than truth." The rapid spread of teachings of Rabbi Isaac Luria and his Lurianic Kabbalah resulted in a grafting of the then-current theories of the Kabbalist onto the traditional Jewish view of the role of the personality of the Messiah. This new philosophic paradigm, in the estimation of many scholars, provided a spiritual justification for proactive Zionism and the events that directly brought about the modern formation of Israel. Mystic Lurianic expectations about the nature of the redemption and the restored world, Olam HaTikun, which follow upon its heels, added new contents and dimensions to the popular messianic folk myth of conquering national hero, raising it to the level of a supreme cosmic drama. The redemptive process no longer simply worked out Israel's temporary emancipation from the yoke of the Gentiles, but rather, it involved a fundamental transformation of the entirety of creation, affecting material and spiritual worlds alike, and would lead to, in the words of Gershom Scholem, a rectification of the primordial catastrophe of the breaking of the vessels, Sheveret HaKalim, in the course of which the divine words would be returned to their original perfection. This process is called Tikkun Olam, or repairing the world, and it involves all of one's actions, how one treats fellow human beings, works, plays, thinks, and interacts with all aspects of the environment at any given moment in time. Therefore, these heretical Kabbalists believed that acts which benefited God included deliberate forays into the world of sin, where the illusory nature of evil could be more readily exposed, and the sparks thereby elevated to their source. The Lurianic Kabbalists originally intended their practice of prayer intentions, or kavanot, as inward actions of thought designed to reintegrate the divine light by helping to restore it to the place it had occupied before the catastrophic fall. Thus, each kavahana, prayer, was a spiritual act demonstrating that the outward undertaking which occasioned it harmonized invisibly with the overall structure of the cosmos. With the advent of the Messiah of 1666, however, this structure changed. The change in turn led it to a revelation of the entire Lurianic Kabbalah, and on occasion, both Nathan of Gaza and Abraham Cardozo, a Sabbatean Murano prophet, went so far as to direct veiled criticisms at Isaac Luria himself. For example, Nathan of Gaza, arguably Zabbatai Zevi's closest proponent, shares some insight concerning the dramatic social changes. In the present age, it is no longer in order to read the Tikkunim, composed by the Rabbi Isaac Luria, of blessed memory and his disciples, nor to meditate according to their Kavanot, prayer intentions. For the times have changed. The Kavanot of Rabbi Isaac Luria were meant for his own age, which was like an ordinary day of the week, whereas now it is the eve of the Sabbath, and it is not proper to treat the Sabbath as though it were a weekday. Elsewhere, Nathan of Gaza clarified his position, once more expressing his belief that they had entered into a new era, and reiterating his view that religious law existed prior to Sabbatai Zevi was essentially obsolete. My meaning is that Kavanot, discovered by our teacher Rabbi Isaac Luria, may his saintly and righteous memory be blessed, are no longer appropriate to our own time, because the raising up of the divine worlds has entered a new phase, so that it would be like employing Kavanot intended for a weekday on the Sabbath. Therefore, let everyone beware of using them, and likewise, let none of the Kavanot or homilies or writings of Rabbi Isaac Luria be read henceforth, for they are abstruse, and no living man has understood them except Rabbi Chayan Vital, who was a disciple of Master Isaac Luria for several years, at the end of which he surpassed him in knowledge. In traditional Sabbatean doctrine, Zevi and his followers claimed that they could liberate the sparks of holiness hidden within what seemed to be evil. Zevi himself would perform actions that violated traditional Jewish taboos, such as eating fats that were forbidden by Jewish dietary laws and celebrating former fast days as feast days. To quote a prayer by Zevi, Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Matir Esorim. Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who makes the forbidden things permissible. You know, the next time they put up Hebrew, I'm not going to even try to do that to my throat. It's not worth it. The process of redemption would remain incomplete as long as the last divine sparks of holiness and good, which fell at the time of Adam's primordial sin, into the impure realm of the Kelipot, shells entrapping divine light, had not been gathered back to their source. It was therefore left to the Redeemer, the holiest of men, to accomplish what not even the most righteous souls in the past had been able to do, to descend through the gates of impurity into the impure realm of the Kelipot, and to rescue the divine spark still imprisoned there. As soon as this task was sufficiently performed, the kingdom of evil would collapse of itself, for its existence was made possible only by the divine sparks in its midst. The Messiah was constrained to commit strange acts, of which his apostasy was the most startling. All of these, however, were necessary for the fulfillment of his mission. The psychology of the radical Sabbateans was utterly paradoxical. Essentially, its guiding principle was, whoever is as he appears cannot be a true believer. In practice, this meant that the true faith could not be a faith which men publicly professed. On the contrary, the true faith must always be concealed. In fact, it was one's duty to deny it outwardly, for it was like a seed planted in a bed of the soil, and it could not grow unless it was first covered over. In the formulation of Cardozo, it is ordained that the King Messiah don the garments of a Murano, and so go unrecognized by his fellow Jews. In a word, it is ordained that he become a Murano like me. For this reason, accordingly, every Jew is obliged to become a Murano. This theme of a secret, hidden, or occult identity became part of this evolving religious philosophy. In essence, a true act cannot be committed publicly before the eyes of the world. Like the true faith, the true act was concealed, for only through concealment could it negate the falsehood of what is explicit. Through a revolution of values, what was formerly sacred became profane, and what was formerly fane became sacred. Sabbatai Zevi is the most famous Jew to have become a Muslim convert, and That is, in most times, the term Sabbatean has come to denote. Many within Zevi's inner circle followed him into Islam, including his wife Sarah, and most of his closest relatives and friends, Nathan of Gaza, the proponent closest to Zevi, who had caused Zevi to reveal himself as the Messiah, and in turn became his prophet, never followed him into Islam, but remained Jew, albeit publicly excommunicated by his Jewish brethren. It is thought by some scholars that Zevi had deeper connections with the Bektashi, Sufi order. Some similarities between the Sabbatean Donma and Bektashi practice include the deliberate violation of kashrut, or halal, ritualistic group sex or wife swapping, ecstatic singing or chanting, mystical Kabbalah, and belief in an occult, hidden reading of the Torah or Quran. After Sabbatai's death in 1676, these sects flourished and continued to indulge in wife-sharing, religious sex orgies, adultery, and incest. The Sabbateans in Salonika, the Doma, regularly held a celebration on the 22nd day of the Hebrew month of Adar, known as the Festival of the Lamb. They kept the exact nature of this celebration carefully guarded secret until some of the younger members were finally prevailed upon to reveal it. According to their account, the festival included intoxication at an orgiastic rite called the Extinguishing of the Lights, which ended in total darkness with the religious sexual sharing of daughters and wives. From what we know of this rite, it probably came to Salonika from Izmir, for it borrowed both its name and its contents from the pagan cult of the Great Mother, which flourished in antiquity and continued to be practiced. After the general demise of the cult by a small sect of the light extinguishers in Asia Minor under the cover of Islam, they said that the violation of the Torah had become its fulfillment, which they illustrated by the example of a grain of wheat that rots in the earth. In other words, just as a grain of wheat must rot in the earth before it can sprout, so the deeds of the believers must become truly rotten before they could germinate the redemption. This metaphor, which appears to have been extremely popular, conveyed the whole of sectarian Sabbatean psychology in a nutshell. In the period of transition, while the redemption was still in a state of concealment, the Torah, in its explicit form, must be denied, for only thus could it too become concealed and ultimately renewed. Some historians maintain that many Sabbateans became followers of Hasidism, which, unlike Zevi's movement, followed Halakha. There are well-known disputes between rabbis accusing one another being secretly followers of Zevi, who had become much reviled in Orthodox Judaism due to his apostasy. According to Gershom Scholem, Sabbateanism is the matrix of every significant movement to have emerged in the 18th and 19th century, from Hasidism to Reform Judaism to the earliest Masonic circles and revolutionary idealism. The Sabbatean believers felt that they were champions of a new world, which was to be established by overthrowing the values of all positive religions. This insistence of the radicals on the potential holiness of sin alienated and offended the average Jew, and caused even the believers themselves to undergo the severest of internal conflicts. The Sabbateans' attempt to justify it by citing, out of context, the Talmudic dictum, Nazir 23b, transgression committed for its own sake is greater than a commandment not committed for its own sake. The nihilistic tendencies of Sabbateanism, still relatively mild compared to what was to follow, reached a new peak in the 18th century with Sabbatai Zevi's infamous successor Jacob Frank, whose followers regularly sought redemption through infamous religious sex orgies on solstices and equinoxes.